To get rid of this pandemic. And that's just the profits they've made during the pandemic, the additional monies they've made. And of course, yes, it would be a good thing if they all sat around a dinner table and said, you know, we've made this extra money, we had enough to start with, let's get rid of this pandemic. But of course, our economic system can't rely exclusively on their largesse. What we are not doing is articulating and then passing the legislation that turns that from a voluntary philanthropic exercise into something they are required to do.
And what would that look like, Paul? We have 15 seconds.
Well, I wrote a book about it, so Power Switch. We've got a Biden and Harris administration that can't just normalize. They've got to pass a range of policies economically, in terms of social protection, that require corporations and the wealthy to pay their taxes and get that money into the system so that people have the social protection and economic opportunity they need to lift themselves from this pandemic.
Paul O'Brien, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Vice President of Oxfam America. We'll link to the new report, The Inequality Virus, Bringing Together a World Torn Apart by Coronavirus Through a Just, Fair, Sustainable Economy. A very happy belated birthday to Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love.
To listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hi, everyone. I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and illuminate the damage military service does to Americans and foreign citizens around the world. How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys the lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false? Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You can listen to us at 9 a.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month right here on KBOO. And thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown allows limited indoor activities as COVID-19 vaccinations continue across the state. A report says Oregon State Representative Diego Hernandez likely created a hostile workplace at the state capitol. And the single article of impeachment against Donald Trump has been delivered to the Senate. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 26, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported 435 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of cases in the state up to 138,587. The number of cases reported Monday is the lowest single-day total in Oregon since October 28th. Oregon health officials also reported two new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 1,882. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases with 105, followed by Washington County with 50, Marion County with 48, and Clackamas County with 46. There are currently 320 people hospitalized statewide, including 75 people in intensive care units. OHA reported that as of Sunday, about 308,000 doses of the vaccine have already been administered across Oregon. Governor Kate Brown announced on Tuesday that Oregon counties under the extreme risk category can now have limited indoor activities, with the exception of dining. The modifications to the guidelines will allow a maximum of 6 people indoors at facilities of more than 500 square feet, as long as other guidelines such as social distancing, mask wearing, and cleaning protocols are followed. Facilities with less than 500 square feet are allowed to have one-on-one customer experiences, such as personal training. Beginning Friday, Grant County will move into the moderate risk level, while Tillamook and Curry counties will move into the lower risk level. 25 counties remain in the extreme risk category. Brown said in a statement, quote, "Until vaccines are widely available with high participation rates, the surest way to lower our risk and open our businesses and communities is to continue practicing the measures we know are effective in reducing the spread of COVID-19. Wear your mask, keep physical distance from others, avoid gatherings, wash your hands often, and stay home when you are sick." The U.S. confirmed its first case of a more contagious COVID variant discovered in Brazil. The case, found in Minnesota, was diagnosed in a resident who had recently traveled to Brazil. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 25.4 million cases of COVID-19. At least 423,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 172,000 cases per day, a decrease of 31% from the average 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 100 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.1 million people have died across the world. Recent reports show that Oregon State Representative Diego Hernandez likely created a hostile work environment at the Oregon State Capitol for two women. An internal investigation into the behavior revealed that Hernandez had consensual relations with two female coworkers who felt their careers were jeopardized when they ended the relationships. Both women say it was not easy to break off relations with Hernandez, claiming his behavior forced them to make a difficult choice between either resuming relations with him or potentially damaging their careers. Investigators cited two occasions where the women received texts from the lawmaker that could be considered, quote, controlling and abusive. A third woman alleged that Hernandez had been abusive in their relationship and that she felt uncomfortable resuming work relations around the legislator. Hernandez, once the youngest-serving Oregon legislator and considered a rising star in the Democratic Party, has been plagued by harassment allegations for months. The report does not officially say whether Hernandez violated Rule 27, the legislature's sexual harassment policy, which remains to be determined by the legislature's conduct committee. The investigation is based on allegations made by five women, identified only as Subject 1 through Subject 5. It has been conducted by lawyers Sarah Ryan and Kira Jahal Jackson with the law firm Jackson Lewis PC. The women included in the report either work in the state capitol or have conducted business with the legislature. Hernandez has denied the allegations, saying the lodged complaints were part of a targeted campaign against him from the Democratic leadership. The legislator says this started when he took an unpopular vote dealing with public pensions, going against House Speaker Tina Kotek. In an October editorial endorsement interview, Hernandez alleges that Kotek warned him before he took the vote that she would ruin his career if he chose to stand against the proposal. Kotek has denied the claims and is calling for Hernandez's resignation. Regarding the investigation and allegations against Hernandez, Kotek praised the courage of the women speaking out, saying, quote, "I believed them then, and I believe them now. I'm focused on doing everything I can to ensure people can do their work without the threat of harassment or retaliation." Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler used pepper spray on a man Sunday evening following a confrontation at a local pub. According to police reports, Wheeler was leaving the Hillsdale McMinimins pub with former Portland Mayor Sam Adams around 8 p.m. when he was approached by an unfamiliar man filming him with a phone camera. A middle-aged man confronted Wheeler and Adams, accusing them of not following COVID-19 rules, saying he had taken pictures of the two dining with their masks removed. Wheeler said he tried to explain the current pandemic guidelines and that he became concerned for his personal safety as the individual proceeded to follow him to his car. After several attempts asking the man to back away, the mayor reportedly also warned the man that he had pepper spray before spraying it in the man's eyes. The incident came to light on Monday during a press conference when Wheeler was asked if he had pepper sprayed a member of the public the night before. Wheeler responded, saying, quote, I can tell you there was an incident. I filed a police report, and that's all I can tell you right now. Audio of the encounter was recorded by Adams on his phone, with a copy of the recording submitted to police as evidence in an open investigation. Adams recently joined the mayor's office, though his specific role has not been made clear, as recent speculation suggested he would be chosen as Wheeler's next chief of staff. Bobby Lee, a former director of economic development for Prospect Portland, was appointed on Monday as Wheeler's new chief of staff, replacing Kristen Dennis on February 3rd. President Joe Biden's decision to reverse the ban on transgender people in the military is garnering praise from many groups. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
LGBTQ plus groups are celebrating President Biden's executive order reversing a Trump-era ban on transgender people in the military. The ban, which took effect in April 2019, prevented transgender people from enlisting, joining ROTC, or attending military academies. Rick Chavez-Zbur is with Equality California, which sued to stop the ban. He says the policy hurt individuals and the nation as a whole.
It was also harmful to the country because it deprived our country of talent and really harmed military readiness.
Former President Trump imposed the ban in July 2017, but it was tied up in litigation for 2 years until the Supreme Court allowed it to take effect. Trump argued that the military should not have to pay for people to go through the transition. Samuel Garrett Pate, also with Equality California, notes that a 2016 study by the RAND Corporation found that the costs of allowing transgender people to serve are negligible.
It's really sort of a red herring. The military covers the cost of health care for service members, period, full stop. And transgender people shouldn't be denied care any more than any other service member.
A UCLA study estimated that there were more than 15,000 transgender people on active duty as of 2014. The order also requires the Department of Defense to correct the record of anyone dismissed for their gender identity. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Two Virginia police officers have been charged for taking part in the January 6th Capitol Hill insurrection. KBOO's Al Khan has the story.
Two officers from Virginia's Rocky Mount Police Department have been fired and now facing federal charges for their involvement in the storming of the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. Former officers Jacob Fracker and Thomas Robinson were charged each with one count of knowingly entering or remaining in any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority and one count of violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. Both defendants were arrested on January 13, 2021 in Virginia. According to the complaint by the United States Attorney's Office, both men were photographed inside the building, a photograph that Robinson said he is proud of. In a now-deleted social media post, Robinson is quoted as saying, "CNN and the left are just mad because we actually attacked the government, who is the problem, and not some random small business. The right in one day took the U.S. Capitol. Keep poking us." At least 100 people so far have been arrested for participating in the Capitol Hill insurrection, many of which were either photographed inside the Capitol building or sent messages on social media celebrating the event. The Department of Justice and the FBI continue to seek individuals who participated in the riot. Anyone with information or visual materials is encouraged to contact law enforcement. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
The article of impeachment against Donald Trump has been sent to the Senate. For more, here's KBOO's Al Khan.
Yesterday evening at around 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the U.S. House of Representatives formally transferred to the Senate the single article of impeachment against Donald Trump. Trump is accused of incitement of insurrection for his part in encouraging the attempted coup on January 6th, when thousands of his supporters attacked the Capitol building in an attempt to halt the verification of the Electoral College votes, claiming the election to be illegitimate. In the Senate chamber, lead House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin read the charge against Trump, saying, quote, "President Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its institutions of government. He threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with the peaceful transition of power, and impaired a co-equal branch of government. He thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States," end quote. This marks two history-making events, and this will make Trump the first president to be impeached twice, and also the first to stand trial in the Senate after he has left office. Unlike the first Trump impeachment, Chief Justice John Roberts will not preside due to Trump no longer being a sitting president. Instead, Senator Patrick Leahy, as president pro tempore of the Senate, will oversee the proceedings. The trial is set to begin on February 8th, allowing impeachment managers and Trump's legal team to prepare for what Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said will be a quick, yet fair trial. At stake, Trump, if convicted, will lose his presidential pension and Secret Service protections. Plus, he would be barred from ever again holding public office, which would be of particular importance as Trump has hinted at another run for the presidency in 2024. The odds of a conviction are not particularly strong, though, as it takes two-thirds of the Senate, who act as jury in an impeachment trial, to vote for conviction, which in real numbers means that at least 17 Republican senators would need to vote to convict, presuming all 50 Democratic senators also vote to convict. For KBOO News, I'm Al Kahn.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker covering the city shutdown of the Hazelnut Grove tiny home encampment. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 46 degrees. The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory for the Greater Portland metro area from 3 p.m. Tuesday until 4 a.m. Wednesday for expected wet snow and winds up to 35 miles per hour. Today in history, in 2020, basketball star Kobe Bryant dies in a helicopter crash in Calabasas, California, along with his 13-year-old daughter Gianna and seven others. The quote of the day is from American professional basketball player Kobe Bryant, who said, quote, "The most important thing is to try and inspire people so that they can be great in whatever they want to do." The Senate prepares for the impeachment trial, the Supreme Court ends emolument suits against Trump, and Biden unveils his Buy American plan. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we track the transition in uncharted territory.
Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States.
U.S. House impeachment manager Congressman Jamie Raskin read the article of impeachment against former President Donald Trump to the Senate last night. Senator Patrick Leahy will preside over the trial that begins February 9th. South Carolina attorney Butch Bowers heads Trump's defense, and jurors will be sworn in today. The Supreme Court won't hear a case claiming Trump illegally profited off his presidency, saying it's a moot point. The court also instructed lower courts to dismiss their rulings against Trump. His lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, faces a new defamation lawsuit. Dominion Voting Systems is suing the former New York mayor for $1.3 billion for baseless claims against their election machines. After the suit was filed, Giuliani publicly admitted for the first time that Joe Biden won the election. The first woman chair of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, is now the nation's first female Treasury Secretary.
The yeas are 84, the nays are 15, and the confirmation is confirmed. The nomination is confirmed.
Ohio Republican Rob Portman became the third GOP senator stepping down in 2022, citing the polarized political climate. And former Trump press secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced her campaign for governor of Arkansas. President Joe Biden signed his Buy American order yesterday, intended to boost manufacturing jobs by reducing restrictions on federal purchases of products and services from U.S. businesses.
When we buy America, we'll buy from all of America.
Also yesterday, Biden signed an executive order to reverse a Trump-era ban on most transgender Americans joining the military. And he told reporters the pace of COVID-19 vaccine distribution could be accelerating.
I think with the grace of God and the goodwill of the neighbor and the creek not rising, as the old saying goes, I think we may be able to get that to 1.5 million a day rather than 1 million a day. But we have to meet that goal of a million a day.
First Lady Jill Biden spoke with spouses of the nation's governors yesterday, saying the White House wants to hear their concerns.
We're going to share our ideas and work across state lines and work together. And that's what's so important, that we all have something that we care about and we have so much in common.
And Harriet Tubman may become the first African-American to appear on U.S. currency, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki announced efforts to replace President Andrew Jackson's image on the $20 bill.
It's important that our notes, our money, if people don't know what a note is, reflect the history and diversity of our country. And Harriet Tubman's image gracing the new $20 note would certainly reflect that.
After escaping slavery herself, Tubman led over 300 other enslaved people to freedom on the Underground Railroad. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Colleen Echohawk announces her bid for mayor of Seattle, and a couple is charged after traveling to Yukon for COVID-19 vaccinations. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An Indigenous woman has launched her campaign for mayor of Seattle. Colleen Echohawk is the executive director of the Chief Seattle Club, a Native-led nonprofit serving homeless people. Her platform is community-based, focusing on people and investing in community organizations and businesses. The Pawnee Athabascan woman has lived in Seattle for more than 20 years. She spoke with local King 5 News Monday about running for office.
I think this is an incredible, progressive, compassionate, generous city. And I just love this place. And I know that the status quo hasn't been working for some of our folks. And I care about everyone in the city. I think this should be a city where everyone can succeed and prosper. And yet we know that some of our community is suffering and hurting. And so I have decided that I want to jump into this to offer a new face, a new kind of way of working in City Hall.
Echohawk says she comes from a long line of family members in public service. Her vision for Seattle includes addressing public safety and affordable and rapid housing, and says there's a lot of recovery that needs to happen in the city. The president of the Navajo Nation delivered the State of the Nation address to Navajo lawmakers Monday from Window Rock, Arizona, as the tribe moves forward in the new year with new and returning council members. COVID-19 response, recovery, and vaccine rollout has been the major focus of the tribe as leaders encourage Navajo citizens to remain vigilant in taking precautions. A number of other tribal priorities were highlighted in the address, including education, law enforcement, and infrastructure projects. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez discussed a housing development plan for veterans.
What we're wanting to do is to create a larger facility so that we can be able to build modern-day hogans for our veterans and those that are not able to help themselves. And for those that want to purchase the homes, they can do so as well. And we also are going to introduce the sweat equity.
Nez is seeking support of the project from the council. A proposal is expected soon. With 2 years left in office, the Nez administration is seeking to work with the council and on local, state, and federal levels. A former Canadian gaming CEO and his wife, an actress, are facing charges for traveling to the Yukon breaking isolation rules to allegedly receive COVID-19 vaccines. CBC North reports Rodney and Ekaterina Baker recently traveled from Vancouver to Yukon Territory, where they chartered a private plane to go to the community of Beaver Creek. They're accused of claiming to be hotel workers to receive vaccines from a mobile team administering doses to the isolated community, which includes the White River First Nation. First Nations leaders are expressing outrage, saying the wealthy couple put the community at risk by breaking quarantine rules. Baker has resigned from the Great Canadian Gaming Corporation, which owns casinos and hotels across Canada. Penalties for not isolating and failing to follow declarations include fines and jail time. The First Nation is calling for harsher punishments as an investigation is underway. The couple did not comment to the CBC. Isolated communities are said to have priority for vaccinations because they're most vulnerable to COVID-19 impacts and are hours away from hospitals and lack resources. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New research shows that pandemic lockdowns have led to a huge drop in global warming pollution, but global emissions rose again as shelter-in-place orders were lifted. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Early last year, countries began imposing lockdowns to slow the spread of COVID-19. People stopped flying, offices closed, and many factories stopped production. In some places, polluted hazy skies soon cleared, and distant mountains came into view.
So everyone had a kind of visceral sense that emissions were down.
That's Dan Kamen of the University of California, Berkeley. His team wanted to find out just how much carbon pollution had fallen. They analyzed data from around the world, and they found that during the first half of 2020, emissions were almost 9% lower on average than in the first half of the prior year.
What we have seen here is unprecedented or close to it.
Some changes might last long term. For example, some people may keep working from home, so they will drive less. But Kamen's research shows that when restrictions eased last summer, emissions began to rise again. So he says it underscores the need for policy changes and investments in electric vehicles, mass transit, and renewable energy.
So that our post-COVID world is greener than our pre-COVID one.
Without the personal and economic hardships that come with lockdowns. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Bees, a key pollinator for agricultural production, are in decline across the globe, according to a new report that studied more than three centuries of public records on bee sightings. Sightings of nearly one in four bee species have not appeared in public records since 1990. Eric Gladys has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A new study confirms mounting evidence that bee populations are on the decline across the globe. Researchers scoured an international network of databases from universities, museums, and government agencies filled with more than three centuries of data. They found that there have been zero sightings for nearly a quarter of all known bee species in more than 30 years. Report co-author Eduardo Zadara says that's a problem in part because bees are critical for food production.
Many crops that are actually of high value, like fruits, almonds, are highly dependent on pollinators. And so we need bees. No bees, you get no fruit.
Climate change, loss of pollinator habitat to human development, and the growing use of neonicotinoid insecticides are seen as primary drivers of declining bee numbers. Neonicotinoid manufacturers have argued that honeybee populations are on the rise globally and have conducted studies showing no harm to colonies when their product is used correctly. Zadara says honeybees have become the poster child of bee conservation efforts, which he believes is misguided. He says once farmers figure out the right levels of chemical insecticides, honeybees are likely to do just fine, and their populations can be restored with enough investment.
The problem is that it's all the other bees. There's 20,000 species of bees. If you put all of the focus on the honeybee, you're going to be missing the other ones. The other ones are actually providing a lot of support for what honeybees cannot do.
Zadara points to a Twitter post he came across comparing bird and bee biodiversity to illustrate the challenge facing conservationists. Zadara says honeybees are like the chickens of the insect world. Preventing the loss of diverse bird species will not happen by raising more chickens. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Gladys.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 26th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Gladys, Antonio Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Residents of Hazelnut Grove Village join host Paul Rowland to talk about the petition to stop the closure of the Tiny House Village. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Art Talk Bus Stop, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and performers. Then at 11:30, it's Radio Zine. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances. We're a bi-weekly show focused on the relationship between police and communities in Portland. Actually, we're now a monthly show, starting now. We'll be on every last Tuesday of the month, so you can catch us next in what promises to be a somewhat tighter format on February 23rd at 5:30 p.m., right after the news. This week, we're going to give most of our time to a press conference that was given by residents and supporters of Hazelnut Grove, a self-governed village located beneath the Willamette Bluffs in the Overlook neighborhood of North Portland. The village's founding was detailed in a recent Portland Mercury article. It developed from a continuation of the Occupy Portland camp in Chapman and Lounsdale Squares downtown, which in 2015 moved to a plot adjacent to the Sisters of the Road garden in the Overlook neighborhood, along the bike path next to Greeley Avenue just after the I-5 on-ramp. With support from numerous organizations, including Sisters of the Road and the Rebuilding Center, Hazelnut Grove grew into one of Portland's few self-directed tiny house villages. In 2018, residents agreed with the city to move the village to a suitable location, and now the city says it has found one, the St. John's Village, a brand new collection of tiny houses managed by the nonprofit Do Good Multnomah. This solution has also been praised by the Overlook Neighborhood Association, which has advocated for the city to remove Hazelnut Grove since the village was founded. However, residents of the tiny houses are skeptical and are resisting the city's decision. Last week, the city announced it would be, quote-unquote, decommissioning Hazelnut Grove in order to do restoration work on the site. The city cites both safety concerns from possible landslides on the slope and the complaints of other residents in the Overlook neighborhood and its association. According to the press release from Mayor Wheeler and Housing Commissioner Dan Ryan, quote, about half of the 15 people living at Hazelnut Grove have accepted spots at St. John's Village. Outreach workers have invited other residents to select from alternative housing options, while respecting that some prefer to make plans independently. End quote. This past Saturday, residents and supporters of Hazelnut Grove held a press conference via Zoom, facilitated by the Portland Circle of the Oregon Poor People's Campaign. It began with a resident of Overlook, an early supporter of the village, Peggy Zabrowski, recalling how it began.
Hazelnut Grove began with a group of activists who were espousing the rights of the houseless, asking the city to provide safe camping for the houseless. Receiving no answers, they decided to act for themselves and got together with other houseless folks and founded what was at first a camp. But then many community people, churches, organizations joined them and helped them structure tiny homes. The village is, first of all, self-governed. They have articles of incorporation and good neighbor agreements that they hold each other to. We have General Assembly every Saturday, most Saturdays, and work out problems that occur in the village between villagers. This is very important to people. And since I found out about them 4 years ago, I've been a neighbor up the hill trying to support them in any way. Thank you.
In a video produced soon after the village agreed to find a new location in 2018, several residents talk about life in Hazelnut Grove and how they got there.
Hello, Vinay. Hello, welcome to Hazelnut Grove. We have our library. This library was actually the first donated building that we received. House of people, we got a lot of good books because you won't carry around a bad book. These are buildings number 3 and number 4 that was built by volunteers at the Rebuild Center. Now you approach the garden area, which AKA therapeutic area. That's my place.
That was our basic initial motivator, a place where it was safe and sober. We didn't want to have any forms of illegal anything going on in the camp.
Hazelnut Grove is a place where houseless or formerly houseless people can come and have a roof over their head to protect them from the elements, to provide safety, security, build social skills, to get a piece of dignity back.
My home was a gift given to me by folks that lived here that was transitioned into an apartment. So they left their home available and asked if I would like it. And I was so honored and so excited. I'm just one of many folks that just got pushed over the edge financially, and cost of living being what it is and our income being what it is. That's what put me here.
So this is my pod and baby porch that functions really well when I just want to sit outside and stare at the rain clouds, which is kind of nice.
The biggest benefit that it offers is stability. If you have to sleep traditionally people have to outside, you have to find an overpass if it's raining. They get crowded pretty quick.
I really didn't sleep maybe 3 hours a night for probably 2.5 years. Thanks to Hazelnut Grove, I'm back, you know.
It seems like shelter is a basic thing that everyone would deserve. And this is just a small example of what can actually be done to accommodate that for people.
Basically, we want to help others that want to help themselves. We're all trying to build ourselves up. And feeling that, you know, the sense we get from one another, our own accomplishments, watching others, it does a great deal for us. So just the opportunity is all we're looking for. That's it.
That was Joseph Gordon, Meg Garcia, and Bob Brimmer. A current resident of Hazelnut Grove, Josh Maurice, was one of those who accessed a home at the St. John's Village.
I thought I'd say something about the new village in St. John's. I'm one of the people who signed up to move there. It works out well for me in terms of the location, a lot of things about the place, the size of the house, the amenities that they have there. I don't really like using propane to heat the place, so it's going to be a much warmer place for me there. But everybody's situation is different. You know, that is not really nearly as suitable. It's not a suitable solution for everyone. There are other people who are couples and have larger house here and like to be together. There are people who have dogs, and this is a really wonderful area for dogs to live. The location doesn't work out as well for everyone. You know, we're kind of out of the way out there in St. John's. And there's an autonomy here, and the way there's a self-organized structure. And, you know, people like Barbie has said, people are functioning adults, and they have a home, and they have a life here, and it works for them. So it makes sense to allow them to be here. And in general, for those of us who are going to move elsewhere, that leaves these houses in Hazelnut Grove vacant for additional people to move in. You know, and there are thousands and thousands, I think, of homeless people in Portland who are sleeping in tents and under bridges and so on. And it would be really counterproductive, to say the least, in my view, to remove housing that is totally suitable for those people. It would be a huge blessing for so many people to live here. Well, there's a lot more to say about it, but I would just maybe close out by saying that the city is talking about being really interested in supporting housing that is safe and respectful and innovative. And Hazelnut Grove really fits that bill very much on all three points.
Several Overlook neighborhood residents who support Hazelnut Grove spoke during the press conference on Saturday.
There are many people in Overlook who support Hazelnut Grove, and I personally oppose all efforts by the city to make decisions on behalf of my neighbors. The city's planned action is both in direct opposition to my neighbors' expressed wishes, and it also doesn't show care. The city is well aware of what decommissioning will do to Hazelnut Grove residents' lives, and to actively dismantle existing housing stability is never okay, and especially unconscionable in Portland right now. The city has a real opportunity here to approach my neighbors with actual care, which always begins with listening. The Hazelnut Grove villagers have been very, very clear about their needs, and I want to follow their example. I need the city rather than to destroy my neighbors' homes, instead to trust that my neighbors know their own needs best and to listen to and help facilitate the meeting of these needs. Thank you so much.
That was Sam, a neighbor of Hazelnut Grove in the Overlook neighborhood. A longtime resident of the Grove, Barbie Weber, spoke to the value of the village to its residents and addressed safety concerns brought up by members of the press. I should say that when she mentions testing in this clip, she means soil testing, as possible soil contamination is one of those safety issues raised by the Overlook Neighborhood Association.
The day-to-day living continues here at Hazelnut Grove, and we continue to hope that our houses are not going to be taken from us. We continue to fight, and we continue to pray that we don't have to worry about these things, especially during a pandemic. But even further than that, I just want to say that, individual governed villages are a very important piece of what's going to continue to, they're a very important piece in solving the housing crisis. The one thing that's different about Hazelnut Grove from the one villages that are being put up around the city is that this is what you call an intentional community. People have to come in and say that they want to be here and meet people. And so there's an element of safety that is even more so with this community. We're very close here. We do lots of things together, and we also appreciate our personal autonomy. So I want to thank everybody for coming, and hopefully you all join us on the first when we deliver this petition. And as far as the safety concerns, we recognize that there may be an issue, but there's been no testing that has been done. And from what I'm to understand, some of the safety concerns are not any worse than other places in the city. As far as the fire concern, we've had no fire issues here in the whole time the village has been here. They've worked with the fire marshal to cut the fire lines, and even this year they went even above that and did the city's part of the work on clearing all the brush from the village up to Greeley on the bike path, which is usually done by the city, but it was done by us this year.
Overlook resident Peter also addressed safety issues and their selective enforcement.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that arguments that is used often is that it's a landslide area. And I like to point to the West Hills, where some of the houses there are essentially falling into the roads below, and yet the city has not told them that they cannot have their houses there. So there's a real difference between where people who have very little power in the city want to live and those who have a lot of power, the people with money. So there's a lot of specious arguments and arguments like there being hazardous waste in the soil. Is there's been no testing. This is just rumor. There's a lot of rumors that go around. Rumors also that people in the Grove have caused problems in the neighborhood, or that they attract other people there, are specious and have no founding in fact.
Yeah, in fact, The Guardian mentioned the Hazelnut Grove specifically in an article, I think a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, which pointed out that crime rates in the Overlook neighborhood had decreased sharply after Hazelnut Cave.
Well, I'd like to comment too, if I can. My name is Becca, and I am a neighbor. I have Overlook. I've lived in Overlook for about 5 years. And what you hear a lot out here is that we need to demolish Hazelnut Grove and put up a park instead, because the land is too dangerous for people to live. Now, the irony of a place being too dangerous for people to live so that we need to make it a public space for children instead is just ludicrous. It just simply does not make sense. There is an established community there that is thriving. And if we're really concerned, you know, we should do soil samples and show that we care. But like Barbie said, there's been no fires within the Grove. There have been no major landslide risks any more than there would be in the West Hills, like Peter said. And also, it's notable that Hazelnut Grove has not had any cases of coronavirus. You know, this is an intentional community that is safe for people right now. Thank you.
Thank you,
Beth. I just wanted to add a little bit to what she just said too, is that if you look at the ridge behind behind Hazelnut Grove, there's actually only one house behind us. And the hillside is also supporting Interstate Avenue, the MAX, and any heavy thing that comes down. So if this part here was really that dangerous, would they have all that weight bearing down on this? I mean, it would be safer even the bike path if that was the case. But that isn't the case. Or at least they haven't offered any proof to say that it is. But I just want everybody to understand, there's not a neighborhood above us. All that's above us is Interstate Avenue and the MAX, and then above that is a hospital. Other than that, there's only one residential house that's above us. So you really can't even see us from any of the Overlook neighborhoods.
That last speaker was Hazelnut Grove resident Barbie Weber again, speaking at a press conference held in response to the city's plan to dismantle the self-governed tiny home village. The press conference's facilitator from the Oregon Poor People's Campaign, Ethan Livermore, asked village resident Josh Maurice how the relocation was going.
I, like many of our friends and family, have been paying very close attention to what the media has been saying and including about Hazelnut Grove over the past couple of days in the past week. And one thing that sort of, and this was a question that we noticed in the chat, we noticed that there have been some inconsistencies in media reporting about how many Hazelnut Grove residents are staying in the Grove or want to stay in the Grove, and how many residents are actually leaving the Grove for another place of habitation. So I'm wondering, Barbie or Josh, can you help us clear up some of this misinformation, or, you know, help us sort of clarify this muddy water about how many folks are staying and how many folks are leaving the Grove?
We just did a count, and it seems about a third are planning have concrete plans right now for other residences, about 5 out of 15.
Okay, so five people are planning on leaving the Grove. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. On that sort of note, we do want to start wrapping up here pretty soon, but I think a question that a lot of folks are asking right now, Barbie, Josh, whoever's able to answer it, what can the broader Portland community do to support Hazelnut Grove and communities like it, whether it be tiny home villages or other forms of communal living for housed and unhoused folks? What can the broader Portland community do, in your opinion, to support communities like that?
Well, I can answer. Many housed people are giving support to people who live in villages and people who live in camps right now. That's a real important step to take. In with respect to the village, please start calling Ted Wheeler and Dan Ryan and telling them, I'm a citizen of your city and I want you to let these other citizens live in peace in the homes that they've struggled to create and have much support for creating. And if you're like me, someone who loves to hold the sign, please come down to the City Hall on Monday, February 1st at 1 p.m. and grab a sign and encircle the City Hall so that we can let the whole community know that unhoused people, tiny housed people, and their allies all want to see self-governance be allowed to continue. We don't see people not living in traditional houses as pawns to be shipped around and pushed around by a system that doesn't accord them full humanity.
You can also continue to sign the petition and send the petition to as many people as you know, and to grow that number as much as we can by February 1st. And like Peggy said, when we do have exact plans for, you know, keep on the lookout for exact plans about Monday, February 1st, and be there.
Great. Thank you, Barbie. And Barbie, I actually have one last question for you. Barbie, you've told me the differences between a self-governed village and a social service managed village. You and I have talked about that quite a bit. And I just want you to really make it clear to everyone watching today, what are the differences between a self-governed village like Hazelnut Grove and one managed by social services? Go ahead and take us to school on that.
Well, even in the self-governed villages, there's layers of self-governance. Okay, I'll be more specific. Like, Hazelnut Grove is ran by a community agreement, and it's also what you call an intentional community. There's a way for the way to get into the Grove is you have to come to so many GAs and then be voted in by the members. And then you're on a probationary period after that. There are other self-governed model villages that are like kind of have overseers. The people that are living in the villages have say so over like certain things, but not everything. So there's the Hazelnut Grove, there's like full autonomy, and then you have ones that are kind of the new model that is coming out right now is they say that they're self-governed, and they in some ways are, but there's still a layer of somebody who makes it the ultimate decision. We're here, we make the ultimate decision. There's been a lot of things said about social service villages have wraparound, what they call wraparound services. They offer you mental health, they offer you drug and alcohol counseling. They offer you other kinds of services kind of in that arena. And I can say emphatically that that's not everybody needs wraparound services. And the president of the Overlook Neighborhood Association has touted over and over again how it's awful that we don't have wraparound services. Well, we're not in need of that. Although we do recognize that some people do need other kinds of services. It's just not provided in this type of setting. And that's why there needs to be more housing options, more permanent housing options. And to me, and to a lot of the people that live here, this is permanent housing option. I don't want to ever live in an apartment. This is the way that feels comfortable for me. Not only do I have the support and of the community, which is different than living in an apartment. It's like a little neighborhood here. It's like anybody else's neighborhood. We go through, it's just kind of in a microcosm of that. But self-govern, it's basically, we have the autonomy to make the decisions about who lives here, what is the, who does security, what happens if somebody doesn't do their shift, and we organize together to get the jobs and the chores done, which obviously in other villages that responsibility goes to whatever provider is responsible for that. All the mowing of the grass and the chopping of the firewood and the getting of the food is all done by the villagers for themselves. Mm-hmm. So, coming from being outside and surviving to coming to here, this is very empowering because I appreciate when people donate things. I'm not trying to say that I don't, but there's a difference when you make an impact in your own survival than it is when somebody's helping you. And from my perspective, it's done me a whole bunch much more good for me to make decisions on my own and to care for myself. That's kind of the difference.
That was Hazelnut Grove resident Barbie Weber speaking at a press conference on Saturday in support of the self-directed tiny home village on the slope between Greeley and Interstate. The press conference was facilitated by the Portland Circle of the Oregon Poor People's Campaign, and you can find a video of the full event on their YouTube channel. The petition, mentioned by several speakers, can be found on actionnetwork.org. My name is Sam Bowman. Thank you for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. We'll be back on Tuesday, February 23rd at 5:30, right after the evening news, here on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. We'll be right back.
Portland. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3.